Welcome to Special Sauce 2.0, Sirius Seed's podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we begin with Ask Kenji, where Kenji Lopez-Ault, Sirius Seed's chief culinary consultant, gives the definitive answer to the question of the week that a Sirius Eater like you has sent us.
Those three things, salt, acid, and proteases, those are the three things to watch out for if you're going to plan on doing an extended marinade time. If I'm marinating in wine or a citrus juice, then no more than a few hours.
After Ask Kenji, a conversation with our guest, or in this case, guests. Today, Chef Ivan Orkin and writer and man about food and media, Chris Ying, the co-authors of the Gaijin Cookbook.
I was like just the whitest Asian kid you could be. And I never invited friends over. I never shared like our food, the way we ate with anybody.
So the shame involved the kind of food that your parents served you at home.
Yeah. I mean,
I had the same shame, but it was because my mother's food was so horrible.
And finally, on today's podcast, a teachable moment in Sirius Eats Test Kitchen.
So you weren't looking at your pot and Uncle Henry walked up and thought he'd thicken your gravy and he just put some flour straight in and now Thanksgiving is ruined. But it's not. We can still save this.
First up, our chief culinary consultant, author of The Food Lab, Kenji Lopez-Ault. And Kenji, Sirius Eater Camille Germany, Kenji wants to know, when a recipe says to soak overnight or marinate overnight, how many hours does that mean?
Ah.
When I soak something overnight, I'm probably not going to get to the next step until the next morning. So that would be about 24 hours, not 8 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a recipe will specify, but not very often.
So the real answer to this question is that there's no real answer. You have to trust your source. So on a site like Sirius Eats, where we are very careful with our directions, if it is important, we'll tell you the exact frame of time. So it'll say 8 to 12 hours. Like it'll say overnight, approximately 8 to 12 hours. If it's not important, then we'll just say overnight. And that could be 8 hours. That could be 24 hours. Most likely, it could probably even be 36 hours. Probably it's fine. So the real answer is it depends on the recipe. So there are certain types of marinades that will negatively affect meat if you let it sit for too long, particularly ones that contain a lot of acid. So if you say you're marinating in red wine.
In lemon juice.
Exactly. So some of those have a very, you want to limit the amount of time you marinate in them because they can really toughen up meat proteins. And so that can cause your meat to turn tough. And so with those types of marinades, I generally wouldn't go even more than 4 hours with those. You know, if it's a relatively weak acid, then you could go overnight. So like something in like buttermilk when I'm brining my chicken for fried chicken or for, say, for making tandoor chicken, you know, like something like that where it's marinating in yogurt, that'll let it go overnight because it's a relatively weak acid. But if I'm marinating in wine or a citrus juice, then no more than a few hours. Proteases, which are enzymes that break down proteins. Anytime you see the word ace at the end of a sciencey sounding word, ace, lactase, it means that that thing breaks down whatever it is in front of it. So protease breaks down proteins. So anything that has proteases in it, so for example, that would be many types of fruit juices, say pineapple or papaya juice or pear juice or apple juice. Also things like soy sauce and of course, you know, commercial meat tenderizers. All those are proteases and those will turn your meat kind of mushy if you let them sit too long in there. So a little bit will tenderize and too much will turn it mushy. So with those types of marinades, again, depending on the concentration, we'll recommend, you know, anywhere from 4 to maybe 12 hours.
Sometimes in our recipes, we say at least X hours.
Yes. Yeah. And then finally, salt. So many of our marinades are actually brines in disguise, you know, which means that they are flavorful liquids that have quite a bit of salt in them. Generally, the purpose of the salt, it's twofold. It's partly to season the meat, obviously, make it salty because salt tastes good. It's also to help break down some of the protein structure in the meat a little bit. And it breaks down, salted meat breaks down in a different way than meat with a protease would. What happens is that some of the muscle proteins, they kind of loosen up so that as the meat cooks, it doesn't expel as much moisture. It doesn't squeeze up and tighten up as much. So that's why a brined chicken breast is juicier than an unbrined one, or, you know, why ham is always juicy because it's been brined for so long. But that's the sort of downside of brining for too long, is that it can get that sort of ham-like texture. Mm-hmm. So if you're marinating a steak and you have it in a marinade that's kind of salty, say something with a little bit of soy sauce, extra salt, herbs, whatever it is, and you leave it in there for a couple days, then when you go to grill it and you cut it up, it's going to have that sort of smooth texture of ham, you know, which is interesting, and maybe maybe you don't mind it, but it's definitely not what most people think of as steak. So those three things, salt, acid, and proteases, those are the three things to watch out for if you're going to plan on doing an extended marinade time. But again, my main advice would be just to go to a good source, one that is careful about this kind of thing, you know, such as Serious Eats, and then you don't really have to worry about it. If it's important, the instructions should explain.
Yes, so what we're saying really is, people who write soak overnight or marinate overnight doesn't really answer the question.
Well, it could, you know, if, you know, some, I'm sure we have recipes that say that. Probably like my fried chicken probably says that. And it's because it really doesn't matter. Like you could do it for 8 hours, you could do it for 24 hours, and it's going to be just fine.
So now we know. We know people should confidently soak overnight or marinate overnight when it says that.
Yes, assuming you're working with a good source.
Thanks, Kenji. Kenji Lopez-Alt is Serious Eats' chief culinary consultant and author of The Food Lab. Now it's time to meet our guests, who are both friends of Special Sauce and of Serious Eats. Ivan Orkin is the owner of two terrific restaurants in New York City, Ivan Ramen and The Slurp Shop. Chris Ying has written a zillion cookbooks, was one of the founding editors of the late lamented Lucky Peach, the founder of the nonprofit Zero Foodprint, which helps restaurants reduce and offset their carbon emissions. And I know this is beginning to sound like a late night infomercial, an executive at David Chang's Major Domo Productions. Welcome, my old friends, man. Chris Ying, Ivan Orkin, they're in the house.
What a lovely house it is, too.
You know, this is like a real, you know, we don't mess around on Special Sauce. You know, you get the expansive studio, you know, with the views out the window.
It's crazy that you record from this mega yacht.
I know. It's unbelievable. You know, it is our mega yacht.
Yeah. You know, just floating down the Hudson. Who would have known that this whole show was recorded on the open water?
Yeah, and we sent the help out, you know, because we didn't want you to feel uncomfortable.
No, I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Let's start with you, Ivan. Tell us a little bit about your path to what I call ramen royalty, you know, which is Long Island College Culinary School, cooking in restaurants here. Like, give us the 2 minute, you know,
like the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess essentially, I have always been in love with food. I happened to get a job at a Japanese restaurant in the late 70s, before anything Japanese was popular or hip. Something struck a chord, and I just fell in love with not only being around food, but I think being around the process and the hospitality and the interaction with guests, and it all struck a chord. So as my life moved forward from that and I went to college, I decided I had to study a foreign language because I failed French in high school. So in order to graduate college, I needed needed to study a foreign language. So I chose a school, University of Colorado, that offered Japanese, and I studied it. And one thing led to another, and I found myself in Japan once and then twice. And in the interim of the two times I lived there, I became a cook.
You became a cook in serious restaurants in the States.
Yep, I worked at Lutes and Mesa Grill, and I did all kinds of cooking, and never tried to work in a Japanese restaurant because it was so forbidding to try to even ask to work in a Japanese restaurant as an outsider.
Even though you worked in the Japanese restaurant, it was your first gig in high school, but you were so far down the totem pole, you were like, I'm just happy to be here.
I was a dishwasher.
That's pretty far down, man.
That's all good cooks should start.
Yes, exactly.
I agree, man. I mean, if you don't know how to clean, then you can't cook.
If you don't love cleaning.
And if you don't love cleaning. And I have to say that I actually, as I've become a better cook, I've learned to love, I actually love cleaning. It's almost like this, when I cook, man, you should see it. I mean, it is sparkling.
And are you one of these chefs who, like, make sure that everybody at their station it's spotless before service and it's spotless afterwards?
Yes. I mean, that's certainly, I mean, of course, Saturdays, you know, it doesn't always go that way. But I mean, to me, when I talk to a young cook, it's always, look, man, I promise you, when you hit that point, when you can like have your station be clean, you'll know that you're a good cook. Because what happens is if your station is messy, you can't see what you're doing. And you just lose track. And then to me, like when I'm in the weeds and I need to get myself back, I even when I was leading the kitchen, I'd say, everybody stop. And I would say, no, nobody cooks. We clean now for 5 minutes. Everything
really?
Straightens, refills, so like, get it all together. Everything gets wiped down. Wash your hands. Everything gets set, and I'm not starting the line again.
Even to this day?
Oh, yeah.
This is what, like, Dave Chang talks about all the time. Is like, that's a lesson you learn only after decades.
Right. When
you're in the weeds. You have to do the one thing that doesn't make any sense at all, which is stop.
Yeah, you have to stop. Because it's the weeds. And if the weeds is something you can't explain to anybody, you have to experience it. But being in the real weeds is probably one of the worst feelings you'll ever have in your entire life. I mean, it's because it's complete free fall.
Right.
You don't know how to. It's like being on an oiled, you know, incline. You're just going down.
Yeah.
So you have to like stop. And then you have to assess, okay, well, where are we at? Why did this happen? How do we get everything reset? And cleaning, for me, is a process where you take control back.
Got
and
it.
And then you can all of a sudden see where everything is, and then you can ask, okay, so where were we at? What are we doing?
But then you move to Japan, and like a crazy person, you decide that, okay, what should an American in Japan do? Let's open up the 5 millionth ramen shop in Tokyo.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's funny because I've thought, obviously, I've created the cottage industry in myself. So I talk about this a lot. But it also causes me to reflect a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I think that, first of all, I didn't see myself as a foreigner. I mean, my wife and I'd be driving down the street and we'd see a white dude walking down the street. I'd go, hey, look, there's a gaijin walking down the street.
And your like, wife was Japanese.
Yeah. And my wife's Japanese. My wife'd be like, honey, you're a gaijin. I'm like, well, not really. Not really. I mean, I live here, I speak the language, I pay taxes, my
And
kids
we should
go to
explain
school,
it,
you know?
to define properly define gaijin. It's really a disparaging term for someone that's not Japanese. That's there.
It is and it isn't. It's funny. It's because, yes, it depends the tone. It depends who's saying it. There are many times when I've been described as gaijin in just the absolute most just, you know, simple terms. Just you're not Japanese. I mean, and it also can just mean you're not Japanese.
Right.
It doesn't mean I hate you. It doesn't mean you're bad. It just
so
means
it's
you're not
it's
Japanese.
Contextual.
Yes. I mean, and then I've also had people just say it with the absolute most, you know, hatred, you know, you're a gaijin, get out. You know?
Yeah.
So it's come from both sides.
Yeah. And amazingly enough, they were really successful. The community in Tokyo were like, we don't care if this dude's from America. Like, his ramen's good.
Well, I think also part of it was that, as I was saying, you know, I didn't think of myself as a foreigner. I was a member of the community, and it was something I was excited about doing, and I was excited about ramen, and I understood the culture. So rather than just sort of like running through like a bull in a china shop, I thought about how could I think of my neighbors, how could mm-hmm. I, you know, and in Japanese culture, introducing yourself, giving small gifts, you know, being very aware of how people perceive mm-hmm. you and how they feel is really important, and I did all those things.
Yeah. So it sort of lessened the cultural appropriation issue.
Yeah, you know what? I did this in this little area of Tokyo. Like, all the people on my little street were all in their, like, 60s, 70s, and 80s. They were the nicest people in the whole world.
They didn't know about cultural appropriation.
Yeah, well, I don't know what this is.
Well,
I mean,
without getting too into, like, the weeds about it, I think it's an interesting point that you should talk about, too, Ivan, is, like, it was a journey for you. Like, I remember we wrote Ivan's first book together. It was more of, like, a memoir. And you talked about the first time you were in Japan, you were kind of resistant to, like, blending in. You would say, like, oh, everybody walks on this side of the street. I'm going to walk on the other side of the street. And Japan really only opened up for you once you decided to kind of, like, embrace your outsider status.
That's
in a
really
different
true.
Way.
Absolutely. And I actually felt a lot of guilt later on. So I lived in Japan twice, once in the 80s and then once, you know, I moved there in 2003. And when I returned, I said to them, I mean, I was going back because I missed it really badly, and I dreamed of really integrating and just being a regular dude living in Japan and enjoying it. And I said to myself, you know, dude, no more. You will follow every rule, you will behave, you will embrace everybody, and you will act the way you're expected to, or you're not allowed to go. I mean,
right.
I made this, I mean, I talked to myself a lot.
Yeah.
That, you know, I made it.
I think we all talk to ourselves a lot. So, Chris, you had your own path to your majordomodom. Wow, man. Wow, that's good, right? Chris works with David Chang at his majordomo media company. So, but your path was not linear. Your path was a do not try this at home path, I would say.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that. Your parents owned an ice cream shop at one point.
You're so good, Ed. It's unbelievable.
And a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah.
And what's up with all that?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with a pretty stereotypical Asian American tiger parent, heavy academic focus, play the violin, play the piano upbringing. It was also stereotypical in that, you know, my parents held multiple jobs. My dad was an engineer and my mom was a microbiologist. But on the side, they had ice cream shops and Mexican restaurants.
I love the fact that it's on the side. They have full-time jobs.
Yeah.
Probably more than full-time jobs. And, oh, yeah, but let's open an ice cream shop.
Yeah, it's just like, because it's the only way to pull yourself up, right? And, like, restaurants are the game that you can get into when you don't really know anything else about being in a new country. It's restaurants and cooking and serving people food. And, you know, ice cream and Mexican food was just what it happened to be. You know, there was never any sort of, like, express prohibition that I do food.
Mm-hmm.
And food was a huge part of my life. But it was also, like, a weirdly, like, a lot of, I think, first-generation kids, like, food was kind of a weird source of shame for me, too. I never invited friends over. I never shared, like, our food the way we ate with anybody.
So the shame involved the kind of food that your parents served you at home.
Yeah, I mean,
I had the same shame, but it was because my mother's food was so horrible.
Yeah, mine too, but that's a whole other episode.
That's a different thing, yeah, for sure. I mean, the food was great. Like, we ate delicious stuff, but it was just embarrassing that your house smells different. And, you know, this is no different than, like, millions of Americans' lives. But that carried on through college. I got a job as a professional cook in a kitchen in Berkeley while I was at school, but I kept these things so separate. I never wanted to mix. Like, I studied English literature. I was, like, just the whitest Asian kid you could be. And I just didn't want to mix these two things. I was like, food is this weird, frivolous thing I do on the side, and, like, it's my weird fetish thing, and, like, I don't want anybody to know this about me. I'm a serious writer. You know, I met Chang and a lot of chefs through Chang. I met Ivan. I met these people essentially, and this was a huge revelation for me. Like, talking to Chang and Ivan and people who you could have conversations with about politics and art and music and all this other cool stuff that wasn't just food. And you realize, like, these are really thoughtful, creative people.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be embarrassed about food. And it has nothing to do with what they do. It had to do with, you know, where I came from. And so when we started Lucky Peach, it was the first food journalism thing I'd ever done.
Right, because let's talk about that, because you ended up with your degree in English literature from Berkeley, I
yeah,
believe.
Yeah, you're unbelievable.
And then you end up working, like, you end up at McSweeney's,
yeah,
right? Which is not about food.
No.
There were some food aspects to it.
It's pretty aggressively not food.
Right, but it's really not food. It's sort of very meta, contemporary culture and literature,
right,
focused.
Totally.
Right. And was that fun?
Yeah, it was really fun and rewarding and made me feel like cool in that hipster way. Like, I was like, I'm part of the
coolest. There's nothing more hipster than McSweeney's
especially when you were there.
Yeah.
It was the pinnacle of hip.
And right. We should tell people that McSweeney's is all about about contemporary literature and Heartbreaking Work of Staggering
Genius. Yeah, so it's Dave Eggers who wrote Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. It's his publishing company.
Which is weird. You know, I couldn't read that book because that book was about my life.
Yeah, we've talked about this. It's like, for even people who didn't have, you know, the actual factual events that Dave
losing
did.
Their
of
parents.
Losing their parents, losing their loved ones. Like, that book really defined this this zeitgeist and this feeling of being kind of adrift and needing to start something. And then the thing that Dave started was McSweeney's. And it was a place for authors and artists who weren't seeing their stuff get printed in big magazines and big publishing companies it found its way to us, and we did lots of experimental, crazy, fun things. And the only reason why Lucky Peach started with McSweeney's was because what other company are you going to call up and be like, "Hey, we've got a food magazine
idea thing. Right?
Do you want to do it?" And we just said, "Like, yeah, sure."
Yeah, no, it's true, and there must have been a moment for you when you were there. It's like when people came to work for Serious Eats, especially in the early days, it was just like, go crazy.
Yeah.
You know, here's your canvas. Your artists, you know, whether you're Kenji Lopez-Alt or whatever, it's like, I'm not going to get in your way. If I have anything to add to the conversation, I will. But otherwise, have at it.
For you, like with Serious Eats, was it more that you had enough experience where you realized and recognized the value of letting these people run free, or was it that you just didn't know any better? Because for us, it was like we just didn't know better than to let people run free.
You know what's funny is I think it was a combination of the two. I'd had a lot of experience. I hated gatekeepers.
Yeah.
I had this abject hatred of gatekeepers. I hated pitching stories, whether it was to my editor at the New York Times or my editor at Gourmet or wherever it was. It's like, I spend more time pitching than I do writing. I hated that. So there was that part of it that I wanted to remove. And I also wanted to make it okay to go deep.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and I assume that this was true at McSweeney's too. It's like, Kenji, you want to write 10,000 words about chocolate chip cookies? Have a ball.
Why not?
And so that was intentional. You know, the other part about me not knowing any better, God damn you, Chris, is that it was true. You know, I never held a job long enough to have any of that kind of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I was terrible at having jobs. The world's worst employee. But at McSweeney's, I assume Dave Eggers was just like, he had that same thing. And maybe it was a combination of A, not knowing any better, and B, that was his feeling.
He was like you. He hated gatekeepers. He had published heartbreaking work. He'd published a few books and had worked in that world and just couldn't stand the systems of it. Couldn't stand, you know, he tried to be a cartoonist and couldn't get his cartoons in the paper. And he was the one who hated gatekeepers. He is the only one who had any experience with them. I started working there when I was 22. Every single person started when they were 22, 23.
It's the same with Serious Eats.
We just didn't know. And like, that's the thing. Like, one person knew that gatekeepers were stopping us. And he just hired everybody who didn't know any better but to listen to him in the way that it was like, just do whatever you want. And that's, you know, I don't know how calculated that was on our part, but it seemed like a smart move on his part.
Well, for sure. I mean, because I hired a lot of 22 and 23 and 24-year-olds.
Also, we're cheap.
Yeah, and you find, right, and it was what I could afford.
Right.
I mean, don't rub it in. But it's true. And, you know, Max Volkowitz, who used to work at Serious Eats and is a great writer, you know, used to say, I never worked at a place where head people encouraged you to go deep, encourage you to go down rabbit holes, to follow your obsessions. Mm-hmm. And I presume Dave Eggers was probably the same way.
Yeah, very much so. Although we didn't know it. Like I said, we didn't know. We didn't know. And it was kind of a rude awakening. And it continues to be like, Ivan and I talk about this kind of thing all the time. And I spent a lot of time at McSweeney's. You know, I was there for 6-7 years. And then Lucky Peach, where we were again with a guy in Chang, and who was like, yeah, why don't we just do whatever you want? Why don't we just publish Thomas Bernhard's Old Masters in the back of the magazine? It wasn't until way later that I had like the very dumb epiphany that this wasn't how most people do
right.
things. You know, like I didn't know. And I think like that's what always intimidates me about like the next generation of people who are trying to do
the
things.
The problem is as you get bigger, that thing starts to untangle.
Yes, it starts to get harder harder.
It's, absolutely.
It's, when you're small, it's easier. And I've done the same thing in my businesses. But as you get larger, you know, and when you start off, you everything's by the seat of your pants. You don't have a lot of money. You just... I mean, everybody's excited, so everybody's like pumped to do it. But then, but then you have problems, or so you get, you know, you have a problem with an employer, you're having a complaint, you're like, oh, I need an HR department now, and I need.
It's
this.
So true,
and it gets very complex.
But it's a balance because you want to maintain that, and you know what, like where the energy came from.
Yeah,
you know if it came from this like chaos, but you also know we cannot run our
right. It's not
like this
chaos isn't sustainable. And you and I talked about this. I remember after you won a beard award. There was that, you guys had that party at the bowling alley at Chelsea Piers, and you said, you know, you kind of made it seem like it was okay to do this in food. Both you and me, and, you know, said that to me, and that made me feel really good because I admired greatly what you guys did at Lucky Peach. And but to Ivan's point, and this is probably where you ran into problems in the end, right, which probably in certainly in large part caused the demise, and the problems that I ran into in Serious Eats is exactly related to what Ivan just talked about. It's like it's one thing when you're just a bunch of people trying to do what you love, and it's another thing when you're playing with other people's money, when you have a payroll to make every 2 weeks, when there's health insurance premiums to be paid, you know.
I mean, listen, I ran a 10-seat restaurant. So for a number of years, I was like, I was the lord and master. I did whatever the hell I wanted, and I did everything myself. That's the other part. Once you really want to start delegating yourself out so you can do broader things, then you know, now who's really watching? When Chris is putting the incredible energy, when you're putting this, because it's your brainchild, you guys are like, you know, it's yours, so you're there.
Yeah.
And but the minute you step back, you have someone who doesn't care as much, and now you start problems start to happen, and you're like, you know, but don't you care? But they're not, because they're not the owner, and they don't care as much.
Well, I mean, look, I can try to sugarcoat it as like some evolution of creativity or some change in how, you know, you approach the work or maturity, but like the fact is like it's growing up, and like that term can have like a negative connotation when you are the 22, 23-year-old. But the fact is, like, you have to grow up.
Yes.
You have to grow up to grow your audience, to grow as an artist, to grow whatever. Like, it's all, you've got to be mature in certain ways that will enable you to do these
but,
other things.
But I wish somebody would have told me that to grow is to have pain inflicted on you.
Oh, yeah. It's all, I mean,
there's no such thing as free growing.
No, you have to, like, but it's not, you know, Ivan and I talk about this too, and it's just like, you have to embrace that pain is the thing. Nothing is sweet without the pain.
Yeah, but it's also fun, you know?
It's fun, for sure.
It's fun to scrap, man.
The weeds, are kind of fun to be in.
It's funny you said it's fun to scrap, because one of the things I'm dealing with now is that Serious Eater came out, which was the memoir about Serious Eats and the rest of my life. And then I sold Serious Eats in 2015, and I don't know what to do without the struggle.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a weird, and I'm not proud of that, by the way. It's not a particularly good thing.
Yeah.
But the struggle was part of my life for so long, to your point.
Well, it's also because it's not, you know, I'll speak for myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's so organic. Like at your level now, it's harder to actually have this purely organic new thing to make because you have so much experience, and now people know you, they want to work with you. But when we're nobodies and we're just scrapping to make something, it's like it's so much easier to you flow with it
for sure.
You do your best. And like you were saying, you don't really know. Chris was saying, you don't really even know that you're an idiot. You're just doing your best.
I think that like this, I mean, forgive me for making this forced segue, but like the gaijin thing, the gaijin idea, the gaijin cookbook, like an element of that is baked into this, where it's like we didn't erase the part of Ivan's Japanese story that was hard, which is him being an outsider, which is him being, you know, for a time not fitting in there, and that's central to what this book is about. Is like you only learn, and it's not really just about Ivan's story. There's no American equivalent, thank God, for this word gaijin. Can you imagine how often that would be thrown around
these days?
But like, we should all understand the value of being a respectful outsider and struggling to understand somebody else. Like, that's the only way Ivan figured out this cuisine. That's the only way we're able to communicate the recipes and the stories that we put in this book is through, you know, the pain and sometimes humiliation or the shame that I'm talking about when I felt about my food. Like, you have to feel a little bit of that to like finally see the value at the end of the tunnel.
So you guys collaborated on Ivan's first book.
Yes.
And I have to ask you, what was it like and how did you come to collaborate? You know, I know the two of you well enough to know that you're both pretty strong-willed. Chris is has a little lighter touch,
really?
I would say.
I was going to say that.
but maybe I don't know him well enough. But What was that? How did you come together, and how did you work out the collaborative effort?
Well, it just purely came up because I got a literary agent that was working with Dave and Peter, maybe, and right?
It was all through Lucky Peach. The very first issue of Lucky Peach, Ivan's arms are on the cover. Ivan's an excerpt from a book that he had written for a Japanese publisher was in the book. But you didn't know what to do with it because that publisher collapsed.
Yes, so I had written Ivan Rahm, the text of Ivan Rahm, and the outline of the text, because Chris flushed it all out. But the original text was written by me, and it was going to be published by Kodansha International. And I had already had photographs. I had a book ready.
Wow.
And it was ready to be edited when Kodansha International folded, and they closed their international arm. They gave me back my manuscript. They gave me back my photos. And they said, you know, good
luck.
Wow.
So then Lucky Peach published part of that?
Yeah, I'll tell you, the first time Ivan and I actually met was in Tokyo Narita Airport, I feel like.
Really?
Yeah. What happened? We went back and forth over emails or something. I was like really interested in the story that we had published about Ivan in Lucky Peach. And I thought, like, I had my strong suit was in editing and oral history, really. And so I thought, I can do something with this. And Ivan and I agreed to partner and became kind of, you know, we just agreed to it with honesty. Without
so
having
I was still living in Tokyo when we agreed to work together, or had I moved back yet? I can't remember.
You were halfway back because you still had the shop. You still had your apartment in Rokokoen.
That's right.
And we were like, well, we need to go to Japan together. And I had never eaten a bowl of ramen in Tokyo. I'd never met Ivan before.
And all of a sudden, he's sleeping on my floor in my 149 square foot apartment.
This place was so, that's not even an exaggeration. It was so tiny. I slept on the floor in this tiny little town. And like where Ivan's shop was, it's not really like the Tokyo of your imagination. It's not like bright lights, big city. It's like sleepy, low slung houses and like a local grocer and tofu artist. And
the definition of off the beaten
path. Yeah.
But that was the first time we met. And I will say this, we are both strong-willed. I do have a lighter touch, thank you very much.
He is from Orange County.
The two of us have never actually fought about anything.
Really?
Yeah.
And so the collaboration was not that hard.
No, because I think we trust each other in our fields, you know? And we trust one another that's not to say we just like isolate our tasks. Like, I know Ivan is an actual reader and an actual person who can write and use the English language really well and tell stories. Ivan knows that I have a cooking background. So neither one of us disrespects the other person's input.
That's a really good point, because Chris is a really good cook. And so, you know, it's really great. So whenever we work together, you know, Chris just understands how kitchen flow works. And he understands.
And do you think if he wasn't a good cook?
Well, I don't know. I think what Chris said was really cool. I think that's true. I think, you know, and I'm a lifelong reader. I'm a pretty good writer. I'm obviously nothing like Chris. It's not my profession, but I'm an okay writer. And I understand grammar and I understand structure really well. So I can look at something written and I can know if it's good or bad pretty easily. And so I think together we could really, you know, bounce off each other's stuff. And then I think both of us are really hard workers. So, I mean, Chris wouldn't have to say, why didn't you, you know, I'm not like that stereotypical chef who's like, dude, you gotta write even one recipe, please. It wasn't like that. He'd be like, I need 10 recipes next week. And I would write 10 recipes and send them to him. And
you bring up something that I think is really important, because people have been asking me on the Serious Eater Tour about, like, what was it like to collaborate with Kenji? And what I say to people is, even though I'm a good home cook, but I'm not going to pretend that I'm Kenji, right? But what we shared was a worldview and a set of values and a penchant for hard work. And if you have those three things, you can collaborate.
Right.
And so people say, oh, you know, you're jealous of Kenji's. You know, to me, it's like Kenji's success is like I'm a father whose son just got bar mitzvah. You know, it's like it's never about that. But in order for that kind of collaboration to work, there has to be shared values. There has to be a shared work ethic, to your point. There has to be all those things, or else you are going to run into problems when you collaborate.
I think part of that value system, though, too, is a shared vision of what you want this thing to be at the end. You know, I think like that's hugely important, and you both want to create the same thing or get to the same place. Maybe you have different methods to get there.
Sure.
But you and Kenji both wanted to succeed. You wanted Serious Eats to be great, and you both wanted it to be a specific kind of thing.
Great. Yep.
And you know, you're fortunate, honestly, having people like Kenji on staff and not having to rely so heavily on you know, chefs. Like we relied really heavily on chefs with Lucky Peach, and I'm not saying like that wasn't a huge honor and a great creative inspiration, but like I'm getting to why Ivan's different, but it's you end up with people whose goal isn't necessarily exactly the same as yours, and so you're trying to like extract a certain kind of thing from them, and they don't want to give it to you.
Yeah,
and like the thing that makes Ivan different, makes it like the reason why we don't really ever butt heads on this thing is, we have a shared goal in mind, and he knows when I'm bugging him to go into deeper detail from something that happened to him 37 years ago.
Reason.
There's a good reason for it.
Yeah.
When I tell him, like, hey, we cannot do this recipe because I am a pretty good home cook and I can't do this and I can't find these ingredients, he's not going to be like, no, like, this is not, I cannot water down my Japanese like experience for the sake of these puny American readers. Like, that doesn't happen.
Sure.
You know, we want the same thing.
Yeah. So, we haven't even gotten into the Gaijin cookbook in great detail, but you did come up with a great segue. So I'm going to come up with a not so great segue. We're going to have to leave this episode of Special Sauce right here. And of course, thank you for coming and thank you for agreeing to stay around, Ivan. And Chris, it's always great to see you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. Awesome.
Now it's time for a visit to Serious Eats World Headquarters Test Kitchen.
Gravy is a sauce made by taking a meat stock and also the drippings from a roast, such as a turkey.
Serious Eats Managing Culinary Director Daniel Gritzer.
And thickening it with a roux, which is just a mixture of flour and butter. A good gravy is all about that perfect, perfect velvety, silky texture. And that's what you want to nail. You don't want a gravy that's too thin and watery. You don't want a gravy that's thick and clumpy and gloppy and lumpy. It's really, really easy to get it right. You just have to know a few key techniques. So I'm gonna melt my butter. It's about 3 tablespoons of butter, just a little bit less than the total amount of flour I'm using. And I'm doing this for 1 quart of stock. Get the butter melting. What we don't wanna do is brown the butter here, although probably would still be delicious anyway. In goes our 1/4 cup of flour. I whisk it around. I'm gonna make this paste. As soon as the flour doesn't smell like it's raw anymore, we can start adding our stock. The key here is to add it in small increments while whisking. It's gonna seize up and make a paste. It's almost like a dough. Add a little more. It might get a little bit lumpy for a second, but it's at a consistency where you can very quickly beat out those lumps. And at this point, it's thin enough that I really can just pour and whisk at the same time. Now it's gonna be a little thin to start out, but as soon as it comes to a boil and cooks for just a little bit, it'll thicken back up. So I've got here the drippings from a roasted bird. I'm just gonna take some hot water, and you can see it dissolving into the water. All right, I'm just gonna scrape this deglazed good stuff right into the gravy. So the gravy is a good consistency when it coats a spoon, and you can tell you can like run a nice line through it. A little bit of soy sauce, which boosts the umami. Pepper, let's try it. So let's say hypothetically that your gravy is too thin. What now? Well, you have a few choices. The first thing you can do is you can just reduce it down. The risks with reduction are, first of all, you lose volume. Also, if your gravy is already salty enough, any reduction you do is gonna concentrate the salt and make it too salty. If you don't wanna use reduction, you have to thicken it another way. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to add a thickener like flour or cornstarch or arrowroot. The key is to not create lumps in the process. So if our gravy is too thin, one thing we can do is make something called a beurre meunier, which is just a mixture of flour and butter.
kind of like a roux, except we don't cook it. Roughly equal parts flour, similar amount of butter. So I'm just gonna mash the flour and butter together carefully to make a flour and butter paste. Lumps form when a dry starch goes straight into the liquid and it forms these little pasty balls. When you intersperse the starch with fat, that keeps the starch granules separate. And then when it goes into your liquid, you're not going to have the formation of lumps. So I just take it and I whisk it right into my gravy. And no lumps will form in the process. And the flour, after a few minutes, will start doing its thickening. So if I try to thicken it with cornstarch, what I want to do is make a slurry. I don't want to dump the cornstarch straight into my gravy because, again, I have a risk of lumps if I do that. So I'm just going to take my cornstarch in a little dish, and I'm going to add some of my gravy to it here first and stir it around. It's easy to get lumps out in a very small quantity of liquid. It is hard to get lumps out in a very large quantity of liquid. And then I'll put that slurry into my gravy and whisk that in. And once again, no lumps. With the help of either flour or cornstarch, my gravy is now back to a good consistency. So you weren't looking at your pot and Uncle Henry walked up and thought he'd thicken your gravy and he just put some flour straight in and now Thanksgiving is ruined. But it's not, we can still save this. So what do we do if we have lumps in our gravy? Well, the first thing we can do is we can just strain out the lumps. That's very easy. Right through a fine mesh strainer, push it through, and lump-free gravy comes out the other side, and all that thick, pasty flour stays behind in the strainer. That's method one of removing your lumps. Horrible, offending lumps. Another option for removing lumps is to just blend them out. You can use a countertop blender or an immersion blender. Let's see how well this works. Should be pretty good. So the moral of the story is lumps are bad, but lumps are also really easy to deal with, even if you make the mistake of introducing them to your gravy.
Serious Eats Managing Culinary Director Daniel Gritzer. More tips from our test kitchen next time. That's it for today. Next week on Special Sauce, Kenji will be back to answer with his usual scientific precision your culinary question of the week. Do send in your questions to specialsauce@seriouseats.com, plus the rest of the Ivan Orkin and Chris Ying saga. All this on next week's Special Sauce. So long, Serious Eaters. See you next time.